Here with, ladies and gentlemen, the sound of the American economy today.
On this vote, the yeas are 227 and the nays are 203. The conference report is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
And that is what you call enthusiasm from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 19th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. That obviously was Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, hammering down the tax bill in the House this afternoon. Senators are taking their turn as we speak. But the truth is, barring something unforeseen, this thing is going to pass and be signed by the president within the week. So with taxes done, we are going to turn the page to 2018 and talk about the next item on the GOP agenda. And here's a hint. It involves government spending. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts us off.
If you want to figure out what Republicans will tackle next, all you have to do is look at their budget blueprints or ask Paul Vandewater.
The budget that the House of Representatives approved would have cut programs for low and moderate income people by almost $3 trillion over the coming decade.
Vandewater is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and he's been tracking the spending bills closely. He says Republicans would cut spending on Medicaid and food stamps. They would also change Medicare into a voucher program, giving seniors a set amount to spend. And President Trump wants to cut Social Security disability payments. All this may be a tough sell.
These are third rail programs.
Max Richmond heads the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Richmond says these programs have long been considered off-limits, third rails you just didn't touch. But,
you know, maybe we need to electrify them a little more.
Richmond says he'll activate his grassroots members, seniors mostly, sending them to town hall meetings in congressional districts. Richmond says Medicare and Social Security could be shored up if we just tax the rich more. Michael Strain is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute. He says Congress needs to do something.
There are going to be some winners. There are going to be some losers. And, you know, every year we wait to do something on this is a year that it gets that much harder.
The big question this year is, do you cut these programs or raise more money to pay for them? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A word here about the stock market. These words, actually, in this order. The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. I say that, well, I say it all the time, but I say it now because of what's going to happen in this economy with the tax bill soon to be law. Companies, as you know, are going to see their statutory tax rate go from 35% to 21%. More money in their coffers, that is, which they are going to do what with? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has today's stock market caveat.
The big corporate tax cuts in the Republican bill would significantly boost balance sheets. Proponents predict companies will pump a lot of that money into new machines and higher wages.
These firms are not cash-strapped for investment they want to do in the United States.
Martin Sullivan at Tax Analysts predicts that instead,
the increased cash flow most likely will end up in share repurchases and distributions of dividends.
Meaning more money in the hands of shareholders and likely a boost to stock prices overall. So Wall Street becomes a major mechanism for distributing the corporate tax windfall, which would help a lot of Americans, right? Not really, says economist Kimberly Clausing at Reed College.
What's more likely is it's really just going to fill the pockets of shareholders who are going to have even more wealth.
Clausing says the top 5% of taxpayers get 68% of dividend income and 87% of long-term capital gains. Only about 14% of Americans own stock directly, says NYU economist Edward Wolfe. About 40% have an investment in the market through a 401k-type retirement account, but, says Wolfe,
people who have these retirement accounts can't really touch the gains until they retire, so it doesn't really affect their current consumption or even their current well-being.
And roughly half of American households hold no stock at all. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
That half of the country Mitchell was talking about that doesn't own any stocks, they were the winners today. All three major indices lost just a touch. Also, and just because Congress is voting on the tax bill today and there's been all the talk about how much it's adding to the national debt, here as of the close of business yesterday is the total outstanding public debt. It's a biggie. Here you go. $20,492,665,673,399.91. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The President of the United States loves his Twitter account. He tweets when and where he wants on topics of great interest to him. And because he is who he is, therefore, he tweets on topics of great interest to the rest of us, often on topics economic and business in nature. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent some time with Trump's tweets to try to find some economic rhyme and reason. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, Kai.
Give me the, I guess, the diagnostics first, right? What jumped out at you as you went through all these tweets?
So it's interesting because they tend to peak, at least mentions of the economy in terms of his tweeting. They tend to peak around big pieces of legislation or the jobs numbers coming out. And he tends to use certain words a lot. Obviously, tax, because of the tax plan. Jobs, he likes to use jobs over and over again, especially around the release of the jobs numbers. You'll see one particular tweet repeating over and over again throughout the time he's been in office where it just says jobs, jobs, jobs. And of course, there's Obamacare, enemy number one, and regulation, enemy number two, I guess.
I guess, yeah. He does like to talk about the stock market, too. And let me just say, for the record here, the stock market goes down as well as up, but he only talks about the upside of this thing.
This is true, and he likes to take credit for the upside of it. In particular, there were several tweets in November where he says, "Looks like another great day for the stock market. Consumer confidence is at a record high. I guess somebody likes me," in parentheses, "my policies." He notes when the Dow hits records. The next day, he said the Dow broke 24,000 for the first time. If the Dems had won the presidential election, the market would be down 50% from these levels, and consumer confidence, which is also at an all-time high, would be low and glum.
Well, low and glum. With all the time you spent with his tweets, let me ask you this question. Do you think he's tweeting as distraction? Is he tweeting for public relations? Is he tweeting for what is your sense of what he's doing here?
All the above, really. These tweets are policy. And in many ways, you can look at these tweets as what he believes about the economy and what he wants the public to believe. He's really setting a narrative with his Twitter account and using the fact that many people are looking at it, both inside the United States and out of it, to dictate sort of how he wants the world to see the U.S. economy. And that really started on Inauguration Day. He laid it out on Twitter. We will bring back our jobs. We will bring back our borders. We will bring back our wealth, and we will bring back our dreams. And when things go wrong, you'll see him tweeting about the fact that the economy is doing great under him.
Right. Let me back you up for a minute to that thing about tweets are policy. The White House has said that the presidential tweets are policy positions. Foreign countries see his tweets as policy positions. And by that, I mean the Chinese, when he's saying, you know, mean and nasty things about the Chinese, when he's saying things about Mexico and the wall and tariffs and all of that stuff.
Right. And he knows that. And he's broadcasting his agenda and his priorities on Twitter for the international audience as well. I mean, you can look to a tweet back in March before he went to go to China. And he says meeting next week with China will be a very difficult one in that we can no longer have massive trade deficits. Mm. And then in July, I'm very disappointed in China. All of these things are ways to communicate with world leaders in a rather untraditional way.
Kimberly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
What percentage of total retail sales, if you had to guess, which you probably do, what percentage of those sales do you think are happening online? It's not a trick question, but the answer is probably smaller than you think. 9% last quarter, that's according to the Census Bureau. So moral of the story, brick and mortar retail isn't dead yet, but the percentage of sales moving online is going to grow. And as it does, companies are rethinking and redesigning their physical stores for the new retail reality, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
On a recent weekday, I popped into Nordstrom's newest store in Los Angeles. It's called Nordstrom Local. The retailer's normal department stores are about 140,000 square feet. This one is just 3,000, and there are no actual clothes for sale here. Instead, Nordstrom is offering what it calls a service-focused concept store. Customers meet with personal stylists, have alterations made, or even get manicures.
What Nordstrom is doing is what we're going to see a lot of more mature retailers do.
Steve Dennis runs retail strategy firm Sagebury Consulting.
When they've run out of opportunities to open new locations, how do they continue to grow? The shift to small formats has to do with getting closer to the customer.
Nordstrom wouldn't tell me how well local is working, but these kinds of experiments are happening across the retail sector. Take Beta, for example, a gadget retailer that lets customers touch and try products before they buy them. Merchandise manager Matt Olsevsky shows me around a small showroom in Santa Monica filled with about 100 tech products, all lined up with no packaging in sight.
Everything on display is set up as if you purchased the product and set it up at home.
Not everything works as well as it should. A voice command robot that looks just like Albert Einstein is slouched and unresponsive.
We're having some issues with this guy.
Sleeping.
Einstein, he's on, but he won't turn on. Let me make sure he's plugged in.
He's hit or miss, but he's cool.
Olsevsky has more luck with a smart musical keyboard.
It will actually teach you how to play piano by lighting up the keys, and it has a kind of gamification aspect to it. And so...
it's like Guitar Hero, and hitting the right notes is harder than it looks, something you'd only know if you try before you buy. The company's recently partnered with Lowe's, setting up demonstration areas in 70 of its stores. Smart home products like a Ring doorbell would usually be boxed up in the doorbell aisle, but are now on display for customers to try. Beta makes its money subleasing space to product creators, but Olsevsky says the company's real product is the information it gathers by closely observing shoppers.
We actually have cameras throughout the store that are collecting traffic information. So partners are finding out how many people are looking at their product versus how many people are actually engaging with the product.
That's what's happening 20 miles south at a store called Fabletics. It made its name as an online-only athleisure subscription retailer, but this store is one of a couple dozen it's opened recently.
We call it brick mining.
Ron Harries is Fabletics VP of Retail.
When you take the data that you collect from that customer in a retail location, you can get to know your members and guests much differently than you could online only.
Manager Catherine De La Cruz shows me inside a fitting room equipped with touchscreen displays. Fabletics tracks each item that comes in here. Let's say you're trying on a pair of leggings and they're too small.
We can go ahead and request a larger size. And what it does is it will alert everyone on the floor that has a device. So you can say, Catherine in fitting room 3 needs a new item.
The brand tracks your likes and dislikes, purchases, and sizing. You might think opening physical stores would take away from online sales, but the opposite is sometimes true. Stores can act as a form of advertising, a phenomenon known as billboarding, where noticing a store actually prompts shoppers to go online. Here's Harry's.
When we open a retail store within a 30-mile radius of that store, the customer now shops with us 2.5 more times than in a market where we don't have a retail store.
The metrics retailers have been using to determine a store's value, like sales per square foot, are increasingly irrelevant, says Steve Dennis at Sagebury Consulting.
Because they don't fundamentally capture the role of the store in driving the online business.
It's no longer about brick and mortar sales versus online sales. It's all sales, and the store of the future is being redesigned accordingly. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's kind of exciting. Like, I don't plan on doing it forever, but, you know, for now, it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, life on the road ain't always what it's cracked up to be, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 37 points today, about a 10%, 24,754. NASDAQ off 30 points, 0.4%, 69.63. The S&P 500 down 8.3%, 26.81. Word from the Commerce Department today that new housing construction rose 3.3% in November. That included a bump in single-family homes that are all going to need kinds of flooring and plumbing and lighting supplies. Home Depot hammered up 0.6% today. Lowe's locked in 1.6%. Package delivery company UPS announced it's ordered 125 Tesla all-electric semi-trucks. Tesla says it's the biggest order yet of the trucks that the company unveiled last month, slated to begin production in 2019. UPS deposited a 0.1%. Tesla down 2.2%. Any guesses on actual delivery date for those trucks? Anybody? You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I know there's been a lot of coverage of the tax bill here and elsewhere, but it's probably wise to remember we are all in a global economy, one in which today we learned that China is going to start its own market in carbon, a way to trade greenhouse gas emissions with the goal of cutting them by putting a price on them. It's a long-awaited announcement. A lot of climate change watchers were hoping it would have been a bigger deal. Right now, it's just the Chinese power sector. Other big polluters like cement and steel and chemical plants over there have been left out. But even with just electricity, China's will be the biggest carbon market in the world. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what's going on.
China's timing in the waning days of the year is not a coincidence.
China basically promised to launch the market in 2017. And today was basically the last day they could do it.
Judith Shorter watches carbon markets for energy analytics firm ICIS. She says it's a big announcement with a slow rollout. That's because a working carbon market needs three things. One,
you need to know how much everybody emits in carbon. And in China, that system isn't in place yet fully.
You also need a system to register the emissions.
That registry doesn't exist.
And finally, of course, the actual mechanism to trade allowances.
As you might guess, that also doesn't exist.
What might China's price on carbon be? Renping Song is with the World Resources Institute. He says earlier regional programs in China saw prices hover at about
$5 to $6 per ton of carbon emitted. But, you know, that may change because it's a national scheme now.
So a lot to be figured out. But he says a measured pace may be good if it helps balance emissions reductions with economic growth. Paula DePerna is with the Carbon Disclosure Project. She says the new market will make China way more transparent emissions-wise.
It will, by definition, have to bring China to standard best practice, international veracity, all kinds of financial accounting will gradually have to apply to the cap and trade.
Though it'll grow slowly and steadily, China's new carbon market is a clear way to show off global leadership. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We're going to take a minute here for a slice of the actual economy, what people are experiencing as they try to get by in their day-to-day. We call it My Economy. Here you go.
My name is Ben Passer. I graduated from law school in 2015, and since then, I've been working in energy policy and law. My loans from undergrad and law school kicked in about 6 months after graduation, so that's been a pretty major consideration for my wife and me, and she's looking at going back to school. We've seen what a recession looks like. We've seen, you know, what impact that has, and we want to make sure that we have some sort of cushion, some sort of safety net to kind of look forward to, and not have to worry about, you know, some catastrophic event happening and not have anything to show for our years of work. So I think we're comfortable where we are, but we do have to make sure that we're chipping away at our student debt and really kind of taking care of that situation before we can think about buying a house or anything like that. You know, we've never had to worry about, you know, anything close to living paycheck to paycheck. But it is, you know, something that we do think about a lot in order to, you know, eventually take that next step in our lives. I started the blog Snack Cellar almost 2 years ago now, and it's really just something that I do in my free time. So when I write reviews, when I'm trying the snacks and junk food that I'm sharing on social media and on the blog, it's certainly a different type of hobby, but that's kind of normal for our generation. People just kind of doing these side hobbies, especially, you know, in the rise of social media.
Ben Passer, lawyer and food blogger, trying to get by. Let us know how things are going for you, good, bad, or otherwise. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Homelessness is a huge issue in a lot of places in this country, nowhere more so than here in California, specifically Los Angeles County, where best official guesses are that 58,000 people live on the streets or in shelters. There is a deep shortage of affordable housing here, which makes it difficult even for people who make decent money to find a place to live. And therein lies a business opportunity. Lodging entrepreneurs who've jumped in to create a new kind of housing option, temporary truck and RV rentals, parked on city streets. From KPCC here in Los Angeles, Rena Palta reports.
Melody Groundflyer lives in a rented box truck that at the moment is parked in the Silver Lake neighborhood in Los Angeles.
It's kind of exciting. Like, I don't plan on doing it forever, but, you know, for now it's kind of exciting.
There's a solar panel on the roof. She has a camping stove, a cooler, and a camping toilet. When it gets hot, she puts dry ice in a bucket with an upside-down fan.
I have a gym membership, and I just shower after I work out every day.
Groundflyer, who grew up in the desert outside L.A., is now a cable technician. She makes a decent living, around $45,000 a year.
So, I mean, I don't have a minimum wage job, but it's a struggle to find a place that you can afford, you know.
She started looking on Craigslist for apartments, but one bedrooms in L.A. are expensive, and in this neighborhood go for upwards of $2,000 a month. Then she started seeing ads for RVs for a quarter the price. A couple ads felt sketchy, but then she met Russell Savala, her landlord.
And I, like, trusted him immediately. He's one of those good hippie people, I guess.
He has a growing fleet of box trucks and RVs for rent in the neighborhood that he and his business partner, an electrician, have bought for cheap and cleaned up.
This one is rented out to Nick.
This RV, parked just south of Sunset Boulevard, has one tenant so far, but he's looking for a second person to take the other bunk.
Two beds, shared living section.
The bunk in the RV goes for $200 a week. For $1,000 a month, you can get the RV to yourself. A box truck goes for $500 a month.
Which is insane, honestly. But at the same time, it's like you don't have a contract, you don't have a deposit or anything. I'm not asking for any of that stuff, so it works for some people.
And in LA's rental market, it appears to be working for more and more people. There's no way to know exactly how many of LA County's 16,000 vehicular homeless are renters, but browse the classifieds for a week and you'll find RVs to live in for rent all over the city. That's a problem, says Los Angeles police officer Sean Dinsey, who recently saw a rented RV go up in smoke.
I don't think there's a code when it comes to, you know, how they're supposed to be maintained. Who holds that person accountable for renting it?
That may change soon. L.A. City Council member Mitch Englander has proposed a motion asking the city to step in.
Do we ban them? Do we make it criminal? Do we have rules and regulations? We've got to have the conversation.
He says sewage is a problem, and fire, a rented RV in the San Fernando Valley, recently went up in flames.
They're not safe.
Currently, L.A. doesn't regulate the market for rental RVs, just where homeless people in cars can park. Savala moves his fleet of trucks and RVs every 72 hours to avoid tickets. He tries to do it while his tenants are at work and then texts them with a new parking spot.
Where did I park? What time was street sweeping?
Savala says he tries to be a responsible landlord and that he has fire extinguishers and smoke detectors in his rentals. and his fleet of mobile units may prove to be a wise investment. Los Angeles has an estimated shortage of 500,000 affordable rentals to meet current needs. In Los Angeles, I'm Rena Palta for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it turns out the gavel hammering by Speaker Ryan with which we began might have been just a hair premature. It turns out the House is going to have to vote on the bill one more time because the Senate parliamentarian has ruled three parts of it violate something called the Byrd Rule. So it's going to go back over to the other side of the rotunda. One objection is about how 529 education savings plans can be used. One is about taxing private university endowments. And the other, according to the Washington Post, is an objection to the title of the bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I'm obliged to mention here that President Trump might have had it right when he wanted to call it the Cut, Cut, Cut Act. House, by the way, is going to vote tomorrow. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's down 37 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ off 30 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.3%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.